working. I put my heart into it, too. But the romance was soon crushed beneath her cruel and delicate heel. I suppose I shall never learn. It seems a fool is not so often taken as a medicine for melancholy as for ennui, incurable and recurring among the privileged. "You've been spending a lot of time with Cordelia of late," said Regan, basking glorious in the gentle glow of the after-bonk. Your narrator, in a sweaty puddle on the bedside floor, having been summarily ejected after rendering noble service. "I am jealous." "She's a little girl," said I. "But when she has you, I cannot. She's my junior. It's not acceptable." "But, lady, it's my duty to keep the little princess smiling. Your father has commanded it. Besides, if I am otherwise engaged, you can have that sturdy fellow you fancy from the stable, or that young yeoman with the pointy beard, or that Spanish duke, or whatever he is that's been about the castle for a month. Does that bloke speak a word of English? I think he may be lost."
"They are not the same."
I felt my heart warm at her words. Could it be real affection? "Well, yes, what we share is...
They rut like goats. There's no art to it. And I weary of shouting instructions to them, especially the Spaniard. I don't think he speaks a word of English."
"I'm sorry, milady," said I. "But that said, I must away." I stood and gathered my jerkin from under the wardrobe, my leggings from the hearth, my codpiece from the chandelier. I've promised to teach Cordelia about griffins and elves over tea with the dolls.
"You'll not," said Regan.
"I must," said I.
"I want you to stay."
"Alas, parting is such sweet sorrow," said I, and I kissed the downy dimple at the small of her back.
"Guard!"
called Regan. "Pardon?" I inquired.
"Guard!"
The door to her solar opened, and an alarmed yeoman looked in.
"Seize this scoundrel! He hath ravaged your princess!"
She had conjured tears in that short span of time. A bit of a wonder she was. "Fox-stockings," said I, as two stout yeomen took me by the arms and dragged me down to the great hall in Regan's wake, her dressing gown open and flowing out behind her as she wailed. It seemed a familiar motif, yet I did not feel the confidence that comes with rehearsal. Perhaps it was that Lear was actually holding court before the people when we entered the great hall. A line of peasants, merchants, and minor noblemen waited as the king heard their cases and made judgments. Still in his Christian phase, he had been reading about the wisdom of Solomon and had been experimenting with the rule of law, thinking it quaint.
"Father, I insist you hang this fool immediately."
Lear was taken aback, not only by the shrillness of his daughter's demand, but by the fact that she stood frontally bare to all the petitioners and made no effort to close a red gown. Tales would be told of that day, of how many a plaintiff, having seen the snowy-skinned princess in all her glory, did hold his grievance pitiful, indeed his life worthless, and went home to beat his wife or drown himself in the mill-pond.
"Father, your fool hath violated me."
"That's a fluttering bottle of bat-wank, sire," said I, "begging your pardon."
"You speak rashly, daughter, and you appear frothing dog-mad. Calm yourself and state your grievance. How hath my fool offended?"
"He hath shagged me roughly, against my will, and finished too soon."
"By force? Pocket? He isn't 8 stone on a feast day. He couldn't shag a cat by force."
"That's not true, sire," said I. "If the cat's distracted with a trout, then..." "Oh, well, never mind."
"He violated my virtue and spoiled my virginity," said Regan. "I insist you hang him. Hang him twice. The second time before he's finished choking from the first. That'll be fitting justice."
I said, "What has put vengeance in your blood, princess? I was just going to tea with Cordelia." Since the little one wasn't present, I hoped invoking her name might awaken the king to my cause, but it only seemed to incense Regan.
"Forced me down and used me like a common tart,"
said Regan, adding rather more pantomime than the petitioners in the hall could bear. Several began to beat their fists to their heads, others grabbed at their groins and sank to their knees. "No," said I, I've had many a wench by stealth, a few by guile, a number by charm, a brace by mistake, the odd harlot for coin, and when all else has failed, I've made do by begging, but by God's blood, none by force.
Enough, said Leah. I'll hear no more. Regan, close your robe. As I have decreed, we are a kingdom of laws. There shall be a trial, and if the rascal is found guilty, then I'll see him hanged twice myself. Make way for a trial.
Now?
Asked the scribe.
Yes, now, said Leah. What do we need? A couple of chaps to do the prosecuting and defending? Grab a few of those peasants for witnesses, and with due process, habeas corpus, fair weather and what not, we'll have the fool dangling black tongue before tea. Will that suit you, daughter?
Regan closed her robe and turned away coyly.
I suppose.
And you, fool?
Leah winked at me, none too subtly. Aye, Majesty, a jury perhaps chosen from that same group as the witnesses. Well, one has to make an effort. From their reaction, I would be acquitted on a who-could-blame-him basis. Justifiable shagicide, they'd call it. But no.
No, said the king. Bailiff, read the charges.
The bailiff obviously hadn't written up charges, so he unrolled a scroll on which was written something entirely unconnected to my case and faked it. The Crown states that on this day, October 14th, year of our Lord, 1288, the fool known as Pocket did with forethought and malice shag the Virgin Princess Regan. There was cheering from the gallery, a little scoffing from the court. There was no malice, said I.
Without malice, then, said the bailiff.
At this point, the magistrate, who normally functioned as a castle steward, whispered to the bailiff, who normally was the chamberlain.
The magistrate wishes to know, how was that?
'Twas sweet yet nasty, Your Honour.
Note that the accused hath stated that it was sweet and nasty, thereby admitting his guilt.
More cheering.
Wait, I wasn't ready.
Smell him, said Regan. He reeks of sex, like fish and mushroom and sweat, doesn't he?
One of the peasant witnesses ran forth and sniffed my bits mercilessly, then looked to the king, nodding.
Aye, Your Honour, said I, I'm sure I have an odour about me. I must confess I was sans trow today in the kitchen while awaiting my laundry, and Bubble had left a casserole out on the floor to cool, and it did trip me, and I fell prick deep in gravy and goo. But I was on my way to chapel at the time.
You put your dick in my lunch, said Leah.
Then to the bailiff,
the fool put his dick in my lunch.
No, in your beloved daughter, said Regan.
Quiet, girl, barked the king. Captain Curran, send a guard to watch the bread and cheese before the fool has his way with it.
It went on like that, with things looking rather grim for me as the evidence mounted against me, peasants taking the opportunity to describe the most lecherous acts they could imagine a wicked fool might perpetrate on an unsuspecting princess. I thought testimony of the sturdy stable boy particularly damning at first, but eventually it led to my acquittal.
Read that back, so the king may hear the true heinous nature of the crime, said my prosecutor, who I believed butchered cattle for the castle as his normal vocation.
The scribe read the stable boy's words.
Yes, 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 ride me, you crashing tree-cocked stallion.
That's not what she said, said I.
Yes, it is. It's what she always says, said the scribe.
Aye, said the steward.
Aye, it is, said the priest.
Si,
said the Spaniard. Well, she never says that to me, said I.
Oh, said the stable boy.
Then it's prance, you twigged-dicked little pony, is it?
Possibly, said I.
She never says that to me, said the yeoman with the pointy beard.
There was a moment of silence, while all who had spoken looked around at one another, then furiously avoided eye contact and found spots on the floor of great interest.
Well, said Regan, chewing on a fingernail as she spoke.
There is a chance that, I was having a dream.
Then the fool did not take your virtue?
Asked Leah.
Sorry, said Regan, sheepishly. It was but a dream. No more wine at lunch for me.
Release the fool, said Leah.
The crowd booed. I walked out of the hall, side by side with Regan.
He might have hung me, I whispered.
I'd have shed a tear, said she with a smile. Really?
Woe to you, lady, should you leave that rosebud asterisk of a bumhole unguarded on our next meeting. When a fool's surprise comes unbuttered, a pocket's pleasure will a princess punish.
Ooh, do tease, fool. Shall I put a candle in it so you can find your way?
Harpy.
Rascal. Pocket, where have you been?
Said Cordelia, who was coming down the corridor.
Your tea has gone cold.
Defending Big Sister's honour, sweetness, said I.
No bollocks, said Regan. Pocket dresses the fool, but he is ever our hero, isn't he, Regan?
Said Cordelia.
I think I'm going to be ill, said the elder princess.
So, love, said I, rising from my perch on the torture machine and reaching into my jerkin. I'm pleased you feel that way about Lord Edmund, for he has sent me with this letter. I handed her the letter. The seal was dodgy, but she wasn't looking at the stationery. He is smitten with you, Regan. In fact, so smitten, he tried to cut off his own ear to deliver with this missive, to show you the depth of his affection.
Really? His ear?
Say nothing at the Yule feast tonight, lady, but you'll see the bandage. Mark it as a tribute of his love.
You saw him cut his ear?
Yes, and stopped him before the deed was done.
Was it painful, do you think?
Oh, yes, lady. He has already suffered more than have others in months of knowing you.
That's so sweet. Do you know what the letter says?
I was sworn not to look upon pain of death, but come close. She leaned close to me, and I squeezed the witch's puffball under her nose.
I believe it speaks of a midnight rendezvous with Edmund of Gloucester.
XV. In a Lover's Eye. A warm wind blew in from the west, completely cocking up the Yule. Druids like snow round Stonehenge during the festival, and burning down the forest is all the more satisfying if there's a chill in the air. As it was, it looked like we'd have rain for the feast. The clouds rolling over the horizon looked like they'd been born of a summer storm.
"Them look like summer storm clouds," said Kent.
We were hiding in the barbican above the gate, looking out over the walled village of Gloucester and the hills beyond. I'd been hiding since my encounter with Edmund. Evidently, the bastard was somewhat put out with me. We could see Goneril and her train entering the outer gates. She rode with a dozen soldiers and attendants, but noticeably, the Duke of Albany was not with her. A sentry on the wall called out the approach of the Duchess of Albany. Gloucester and Edmund appeared in the courtyard, followed by Regan and Cornwall. Regan was working to keep her eyes off Edmund's bandaged ear.
"This should be interesting," said I. "They swarm like vultures over a corpse."
"Britain's the corpse," said Kent. "And we baited her to be torn apart."
"Nonsense, Kent. Leah's the corpse. But ambitious scavengers do not wait for his death to begin their dining." "You've a deeply wicked side, Pocket."
"Truth has a deeply wicked side, Kent."
"There's the king," said Kent. "No one attends him. I should go to him."
Leah shuffled into the courtyard, wearing his heavy fur cape. "Like looking down on an obricious chess set, isn't it?" The king moves in tiny steps with no direction, like a drunkard trying to avoid the archer's bolt. The others work their strategies and wait for the old man to fall. He has no power, yet all power moves in his orbit and to his mad whim. Do you know that there is no fool piece on the chessboard, Kent?
Methinks the fool is the player,
the mind above the moves.
Well, that's a scratchy spot of catwank. I turned to the old knight.
But bloody well said. Go to Leah, then. Edmund won't dare molest you, and Cornwall must pretend some contrition for throwing you into the stocks. The princesses will be burning bright for Edmund's eye, and Gloucester... Well, Gloucester proffers hospitality before jackals. He is well occupied.
What will you do?
I seem to have rendered myself undesirable, as impossible as that sounds. I need to find us a spy. Someone more stealthy, devious, and underhanded than my own sweet nature allows.
Good luck with that, said Kent. I loathe you. I despise you. I curse your existence and the foul demons that spawned you.
You sicken me with anger and bilious hatred.
Oswald, said I, you're looking well.
Drool and I had intercepted him in a corridor. There is an unwritten edict that when negotiating with an enemy, one does not reveal his knowledge of that enemy's agenda, even unto death. It's a point of honour of sorts. But I see it as petty play-acting, and I had no intention of indulging in it with Oswald. Yet I had need of his spidery talents, so some finesse was required.
I would give an arm to see you hang, fool, said Oswald.
Oh, an excellent starting point, said I. Don't you think, Drool?
I pocket, said Drool, who loomed between Oswald and me, a thick table leg unsuccessfully concealed behind his back.
Oswald might make as to draw his sword, but Drool would have beaten his brains into bloody marmalade before the blade cleared its scabbard. Unspoken, but understood.
Smashing good start, said the giant.
So, Oswald, let us go from there. Say you get what you want. Say you lose an arm, and I am hanged. How then is life better for your fine self? Your quarters more comfortable? Wine taste better, will it?
It's unlikely, but let's explore the possibilities, shall we?
Very well, said I. You first. Sever an arm, and Drool here will hang me.
You have my word. You have my word, said Drool, in my voice.
Stop wasting my time, fool.
My lady is arriving, and I need to go to her. Ah, there's the rub, Oswald. What do you want? What do you really want?
You could never know.
Your lady's approval.
I have that.
Ah, that's right. Your lady's love.
Oswald became still then, as if I'd taken the breath from the corridor in which we stood. To prove such was not the case, I pressed on. You want your lady's love, her respect, her power, her submission, her bottom in the air before you, her begging for satisfaction and mercy. That about it?
I'm not so base as you, fool.
And yet the very reason you hate me is that I have been to that place.
You have not. She has not loved you, nor respected you, nor given you power. You were an amusement at best. Yet I know the way there, my cold-hearted friend. I know the way a servant might find such favour. She could never. I am of common blood.
Oh, I'm not saying I could make you a duke, only that you would be her lord in body, heart, and mind. You know her weakness for scoundrels, Oswald. Did you yourself not pimp your lady to Edmund?
I did not. I only delivered a message, and Edmund is heir to an earldom. Just this bloody week he is.
And don't act as if you don't know what was in that message. I have the power, Oswald, given me by 3 witches in the Great Burnham Wood, to put a spell upon your lady so she will adore and desire you. Oswald laughed, not something he did often. His face was not fit for it, and he looked like he had something caught in his back teeth.
What kind of fool do you think me? Out of the way.
And all you have to do is what your lady would have you do anyway. Serve her desires, said I. I needed to make my case quickly. She is bewitched already, you know. You were there. Oswald had been backing away from Drool, off to find another route to the courtyard in Goneril, when he stopped.
You were there, Oswald. At Albany.
Goneril was having a grab at my tackle and you came in. You'd just come through the door. I heard it. I had this purse in my hand. I held up the silk pouch the witches had given me.
Remember? I was there,
and I handed your lady a letter and said it was from Edmund of Gloucester, remember?
Aye. And she dumped you on your arse.
Right you are, and sent you here to deliver a message to Edmund. Has she ever made a note of the bastard before, Oswald? You are with her nearly every waking moment. Has she noted him before?
No, not once. She gave some notice to Edgar, but not the bastard.
Exactly. She is bewitched to love Edmund, and I can do the same for you. You will die a frustrated toady any other way, Oswald. I've one more spell left. Oswald took careful steps back to me, like he was walking a wire rather than the stone floor of a castle corridor. Why wouldn't you use it for yourself?
Well, for one, you would know, and I presume you would not be slow to inform Lord Albany, who would quickly have me hanged. And second, I had three such spells, and I have used one for myself already.
Not the Duchess of Cornwall.
I could tell Oswald was aghast at the idea, yet there was an excitement in his eye. I showed him a sly grin and flicked the bells of my hat with Jones. I've a rendezvous with her this very night after the Yule feast, midnight in the abandoned North Tower.
You dastardly little monster.
Oh, sod off, Oswald. Would you have a princess of your own or not?
What do I have to do?
Almost nothing, said I. But it will take some strength of character for you to see this through. First, you must counsel your lady to keep peace with her sister, and convince her to relieve Lear of the remainder of his force. Then, you must have your lady rendezvous with Edmund at the second bell of the watch.
2 in the bloody morning?
Watch how she leaps at the chance. She's bewitched, remember? It is critical that she ally herself with the House of Gloucester, even if it is in secret. I know that will be difficult for you, but you must endure it. If you're going to have the lady and her power, someone will have to dispatch the Duke of Albany, someone who will be of no loss when hanged. The bastard Edmund is perfect for the part, is he not? Oswald nodded, his eyes getting larger with my every word. His whole life he had carried messages and run errands for Goneril, but at last he could see reward in sight for being intrigue's pawn. Fortunately, the possibility blinded him to reason.
When will the lady be mine?
When all is in place, catch fart, when all is in place. What do you know of a military force coming from France?
Why, nothing.
Then skulk and eavesdrop. Edmund knows of such a force, or he has constructed a rumour. Find out what you can. Find out, but do not speak to Edmund of his rendezvous with your lady. He thinks it a secret. Oswald stood to his full height. He had been bending over to talk face to face with me.
What do you gain from this fool?
I had hoped he wouldn't ask. Like you, even with love, there are those who would stand in the way of my happiness. I need you and those affected by your deeds to help them out of my way.
You would kill the Duke of Cornwall?
He is one. But no matter who loves me, I am bound to Lear. I am his slave.
So you would kill the king, too?
No worries, fool. I can do that. You have a deal.
Fuck stockings, said I.
Jolly good show, Pocket, said Kent. Go looking for a messenger and end up setting a bloody assassin loose on the king. A born diplomat you are.
Sarcasm is very unattractive in the elderly Kent. I couldn't very well call him off. My sincerity would have been questioned.
You weren't being sincere.
Well, conviction, then. Just stay by Lear during the Yule feast and don't let him eat anything unless you've eaten it first. If I know Oswald, he'll try to slay the king using the most cowardly means.
Or not at all.
What?
What makes you think Oswald was telling you the truth any more than you were telling it to him?
I'm counting on his lying to a degree.
But to what degree?
I paced in a circle around our little tower room. What a wimpled wagon of nunwank this is! I'd rather juggle fire blindfolded. I'm not built for these dark dealings. I'm better suited for laughter, children's birthdays, baby animals and friendly bonking. The sodding witches got it wrong.
And yet you've set a civil war in motion and sent an assassin after the king, said Kent. Grand ambition for a children's birthday clown, don't you think?
You've become bitter in your dotage, you know.
Well, perhaps my duties as food taster will end my bitterness.
Just keep the old man alive, Kent. Since the Yule feast is still on, I take it dear Regan didn't tell Leah that she was taking his knights yet.
The lady tried to make peace between Goneril and her father. She only served to calm the old man enough that he agreed to come to the feast.
Good. No doubt she'll make a move on the morrow. I grinned. If she is well enough.
Wicked, said Kent.
Justice, said I. Regan came up the spiral stairs alone. The single candle she carried in a storm lantern cast her shadow tall up the stone wall, like the very spectre of a shaggable death. I stood outside the solar door, candelabra in one hand, the door latch in the other. "Happy Christmas, kitten," said I. "Well, that feast was complete crap, wasn't it? Bloody Gloucester pagan twat, calling it the Feast of St. Stephen instead of Christmas. There's no presents on the Feast of Bloody Stephen. Without presents, I'd rather celebrate Yule for the winter solstice. At least then you get to sacrifice a pig and build a cracking huge fire." "Gloucester was being deferential to your Christian beliefs as it was, love. The holiday is Saturnalia for him and Edmund. Proper orgy it is. So perhaps there's a present for you yet to be unwrapped." She smiled then. "Perhaps. Edmund was so coy at the feast, barely looking my way. Fear of Cornwall, I suppose. But you were right. His ear was bandaged."
"Aye, lady. And I'm to tell you that he's a bit modest about it. He may not wish to be fully seen."
"But I saw him at the feast."
"Aye, but he's hinted that there may have been other self-punishment performed in your honour, and he's shy. A joyous child at Christmas, she suddenly was. Visions of a bloke lashing himself, dancing in her head.
Oh, Pocket, do let me in."
And so I did.
I opened the door and slipped the storm lantern from her grasp as she passed.
"Ah, love, no more light than that one candle. He's ever so shy."
I heard Edmund's voice say from behind the tapestry,
"Oh, my sweet Lady Regan, thou art more fair than moonlight, more radiant than the sun, more glorious than all the stars. I must have you, or I shall surely die."
I slowly closed and latched the door.
"No, my goddess. Undress there," said Edmund's voice. "Let me watch you."
I'd been all evening coaching Drool on what to say and exactly how to say it. Next he would comment on her loveliness, then ask her to blow out the single candle on the table and join him behind the tapestry, at which point he was to unceremoniously snog her soggy and shag her silly. It sounded rather like what I'd guess would be the auditory effect of a bull elk trying to balance a wildcat on a red-hot poker. There was no little bit of yowling, growling, squealing and screeching going on by the time I saw the second light coming up the stairs. I could see by the shadow that the lantern-bearer was leading with a drawn sword. Oswald had been true to his treacherous nature, just as I had calculated.
"Put that blade down, you git, you'll put someone's eye out."
The Duke of Cornwall rounded the stairs with blade lowered, a bewildered look on his face.
"Fool?"
"What if a child was running down the stairs?" I said.
"Awkward explaining to Gloucester why his beloved toddler grandson was wearing a yard of Sheffield steel through his gizzard."
"Gloucester doesn't have a grandson," said Cornwall, surprised, I think, that he was engaged in this discussion. "That doesn't diminish the need for basic weapons safety."
"But I'm here to slay you."
"Moi?" said I in perfect fucking French. "Whatever for?"
"Because you're shagging my lady."
There was a great bellow from the tower room, followed by a female feral screech.
"Was that pain or pleasure, would you say?" I asked.
"Who is in there?"
Cornwall raised his sword again.
"Well, it is your lady,
and she is most certainly being shagged,
by the bastard Edmund of Gloucester. But prudence would have you stay your blade. I laid Jones across the Duke's wrist and pushed his sword hand down. Unless you care nothing for being King of Britain.
What are you on about, fool?
The Duke very much wanted to do some killing, but his ambition was trumping his bloodlust.
Oh, ride me, you great tree-cocked rhinoceros!
Screamed Regan from the next room.
She still says that? I asked.
Well, usually it's tree-cocked stallion, said Cornwall.
She does get good wear out of a metaphor. I put my hand on his shoulder for comfort.
Aye, a sad surprise for you, I wager. At least when a man, after looking into his soul, finally stoops to fuck a snake, he hopes at least not to see pairs of boots already lined up outside her burrow.
He shook me off.
I'll kill him.
Cornwall, you're about to be attacked. Even now, Albany prepares to take all of Britain for his own. You'll need Edmund and the forces of Gloucester to prevail against him, and when you do, you'll be king. If you go into that room now, you will kill a horn beast, but you will lose a kingdom.
God's blood, said Cornwall. Is this true?
Win the war, good sirrah. Then kill the bastard at your leisure, when you can take your time and do it right.
Regan's honour is, well, malleable, is it not? You're sure about this war?
Aye. It's why you need to take Lear's remaining knights and squires, just as Goneril and Albany took the others, and you mustn't let Goneril know you know. Even now, your lady is assuring Gloucester's allegiance to your side.
Really? That's why she's shagging Edmund?
It hadn't occurred to me until I said it, but it really did work quite nicely.
Oh yes, my lord. Her enthusiasm is inspired by her fierce loyalty to you. Of course, said Cornwall, sheathing his sword. I should have seen it.
That doesn't mean you can't kill Edmund when it's over, said I.
Absolutely, said the Duke.
When Cornwall was gone, and sometime after the first bell had rung for the watch, I knocked on the door and peeked my head in.
Lord Edmund, said I, there's a stirring in the Duke's tower. Perhaps you should say your farewells.
I held Regan's storm lantern at the crack of the door so she could find her way out, and a few moments later she stumbled out of the solar with a gown on backward, her hair in knots, and a slick of drool running in a river between and over her breasts. Overall, in fact, she looked quite slippery. She was dazed and limping in a way that seemed she couldn't quite figure which side to favour, and she was dragging one shoe by its strap around her ankle.
"Lady, shall I get your other shoe?"
"Sod it," she said, waving drunkenly, or what seemed like drunkenly, almost falling down the stairs. I steadied her, helped her get her gown turned around, swabbed her down a bit with her skirt, then took her arm and helped her down the stairs.
"He's quite a bit larger close up than he appears across the room."
"That's so."
"I shan't sit down for a fortnight."
"Ah, sweet romance.
Can you make it to your quarters, kitten?"
"I think so."
"You're clever, Pocket. Start thinking of excuses for Edmund if I'm not able to get out of bed tomorrow."
"My pleasure, kitten. Sleep well." I made my way back upstairs where Drool was standing trouserless by the candle, still sporting enough of an erection to bludgeon a calf senseless.
"Sorry I came out, Pocket. It were dark."
"No worries, lad. Good show."
"She were fit."
"Aye, quite."
"What's a rhinoceros?"
"It's like a unicorn with armoured bollocks. It's a good thing. Chew these mint leaves and let's get you wiped down. Practice your Edmund lines while I look for a towel." When the watch rang the second bell, the scene was set. Another storm lantern illuminated the stairs and cast a buxom shadow up the wall.
"Pumpkin!"
"What are you doing here, worm?"
"Just keeping watch. Go in, but leave your lantern with me. Edmund is shy about the injury he has inflicted on himself in your honour." Goneril grinned at the prospect of the bastard's pain and went in. A few minutes passed before Oswald crept up the stairs.
"Fool,
You're still alive?
Aye. I held my hand up to my ear. But listen to the children of the night, what music they make.
Sound like a moose trying to shit a family of hedgehogs, said the scoundrel.
Oh, that's good. I was thinking more of a moo cow being beaten with a flaming goose, but you may have it.
Ah, who's to say?
We should leave, good Oswald, and give the lovers their privacy.
Did you not meet with Princess Regan?
Oh, we changed the rendezvous to the fourth bell of the watch. Why?
Sixteen. A storm rising. The storm blew in during the night. I was eating my breakfast in the kitchen when a row erupted in the courtyard. I heard Leah bellow, then left to attend him, leaving my porridge with Drool. Kent intercepted me in the corridor.
So, the old man lived through the night, said I.
I slept at his door, said Kent.
Where were you?
Trying to see two princesses ruthlessly shagged and starting a civil war, thank you. And with no proper supper, neither.
Fine feast, said Kent. Ate till I nearly burst just to see the king went unpoisoned.
Who is bloody Saint Stephen, anyway?
Then I saw Oswald coming down the corridor.
Good Kent, go see that the daughters don't kill the king, and that Cornwall doesn't kill Edmund, and that the sisters don't kill each other, and if you can help it, don't kill anyone. It's too early for killing.
Kent hurried off as Oswald reached me.
So, said Oswald, you live through the night?
Of course, why wouldn't I?
I asked. Well, because I told Cornwall of your rendezvous with Regan and I expected him to slay you.
Oh, for fuck's sake, Oswald, show a little guile, would you? The state of villainy in this castle is rubbish. What with Edmund being pleasant and you being straightforward, what's next? Cornwall starts feeding orphans while bloody bluebirds fly out of his bum. Now, let's try it again. See if you can at least keep up a pretense of evil.
Go. So, you live through the night? Said Oswald.
Of course. Why wouldn't I? I asked.
Oh, no reason. I was worried about you.
I clouted Oswald on the ear with Jones.
No, you nitwit. I'd never believe your concern for my welfare. You're a right weasel, aren't you?
He made to reach for his sword, and I hit his wrist, a vicious blow, with Jones's stick end. The villain leapt back and rubbed his bruised wrist. Despite your incompetence, our agreement stands. I need you to consult with Edmund. Give him this letter from Regan. I handed him the letter I'd written at first light. Regan's hand was easy to duplicate. She dotted her I's with hearts. Don't break the seal. It professes her devotion for him, but instructs him to show no outward affection for her. You must also caution him against showing any deference to your Lady Goneril in front of Regan. And because I know the intrigue confuses you, let me map out your interest here. Edmund will dispatch your Lord Albany, thus releasing your lady to other affections. Only then will we reveal to Cornwall that Edmund has cuckolded him with Regan, and the Duke will dispatch the bastard, at which time I will cast the love spell on Goneril, sending her into your own ferrety arms.
You could be lying. I tried to have you killed. Why would you help me?
Excellent question. First, I, unlike you, am not a villain. Therefore, I can be expected to proceed with a modicum of integrity. And second, I wish to visit revenge on Goneril for how she has treated me, her younger sister Cordelia, and King Lear. I can think of no better punishment for her than pairing her with the man-shaped tower of excrement that is yourself.
Oh, that's reasonable, said Oswald.
Off you go, then. See that Edmund doesn't show deference.
I might slay him myself for violating my lady.
No, you won't. You're a coward. Or had you forgotten?
Oswald started to quiver then with anger, but he did not try to reach for his sword.
Run along, mate. Pocket's got a bumload of fooling yet to do.
A randy hand of wind groped the courtyard, sending the sisters' skirts tossing and snapping their hair in their faces. Kent crouched and clung to his great broad-brimmed hat to keep it from being carried away.
The old king held his fur cape tight around him and squinted against the dust, while the Duke of Cornwall and Earl of Gloucester stood by the great gate for shelter, the Duke content, it seemed, to let his Duchess do the talking. I was relieved to see that Edmund was not in attendance, so I danced into the courtyard, bells a-jingle, song in heart. "Hi-ho," said I. "Everyone get a proper bonking for the Saturnalia, did they?" The two sisters looked at me blankly, as if I might have been speaking Chinese or dog, and they had not, overnight, each received rousing repeated bonkings from an enormous donkey-donged nitwit. Gloucester looked down, embarrassed, I suppose, over abandoning his own pantheon for St. Stephen, and a holy bollocks holy holiday feast. Cornwall sneered. "Ah," said I, "then a crispy biscuit baby Jesus corn you bloody copia of Christmas cheer, was it? Silent night, camels and wise men, Frankenstein, gold and myrrh all around then."
"Sodding Christian harpies want to take away my knights," said Lear. "I've already lost half my train to you, Goneril. I'll not lose the rest."
"Oh yes, sire," said I. "Christianity is their fault. I forgot that the wind blew out of a pagan sky for you today." Regan stepped forward then, and yes, she was walking a bit bow-legged.
"Why do you need to keep 50 men, father? We've plenty of servants to tend to you."
"And," said Goneril, "they will be under our charge, so there will be no discord within the walls of our homes."
"I'm of my sister's mind on this," said Regan.
"You're always of your sister's mind," said Lear. "An original thought would crack your feeble skull like a thunderbolt, you craven vulture."
"That's the spirit, sire," said I. "Treat them like bins of used nappies and watch them come around. I wonder they've turned out so delightful with fathering of that quality."
"Take them, then, you flesh-tearing harpies. Would that I could drag your mother from her tomb and accuse her of most grievous adultery, for you cannot be issue from my loins and treat me so."
I nodded and lay my head on Goneril's shoulder. Evidently the adultery comes from Mum's side of the family pumpkin. The bitterness and stunning bosoms are from Papa. She pushed me aside, despite my wisdom.
Lear was losing all control now, trembling as he shouted impotently at his daughters, looking weaker and more slight with every word.
"Hear me, gods! If it be you that stirs these daughters' hearts against their father, then touch me with noble anger, and stain not my man's cheeks with woman's weapons, the water drops."
"Those aren't tears on your cheeks, Nuncle," said I. "It's raining." Gloucester and Cornwall looked away, embarrassed for the old man. Kent had his hands on the king's shoulders and was trying to lead him gently out of the rain. Lear shrugged him off and stormed up to his daughters.
"You unnatural hags! I will have such revenges on you both that the world... I will do such things that I don't even know yet, but they will be horrible, the very terrors of the earth. But I'll not weep. I'll not. Even if my heart shall break into 100,000 shards, I shall not weep. Oh, fool! I shall go mad!"
"Aye, Nuncle, smashing good start you're off to." I tried to put an arm around Leah's shoulders, but he elbowed me away.
"Rescind your orders, harpies, or I shall leave this house."
He made for the great gate.
"It's for your own good, father," said Goneril. "Now, cease this ranting and come inside."
"I gave you all," screeched Leah, waving a palsied claw at Regan.
"And you took your bloody time giving it to you, senile old fuck," said Regan.
"She came up with that one all on her own, Nuncle," said I, looking on the bright side.
"I will go,"
threatened Lear, another step toward the gate. "I'm not having you on. I'll head right out that door."
"Pity," said Goneril. "Shame, really," said Regan.
"Here I go. Right out that gate, never to return. All alone."
"Ta," said Goneril.
"Au revoir," said Regan, in nearly perfect fucking French.
"I mean it."
The old man was actually through the gate now.
"Close it," said Regan.
"But, lady, it is not fit for man nor beast out there," said Gloucester.
"Fucking close it," said Goneril.
She ran forward and pushed the great iron lever by the gatehouse with all her might. The heavy ironclad portcullis slammed down, the points just missing the old king as they set in the ports a foot deep in the stone.
"I'll go," said Leah through the grate. "Don't think I won't."
The sisters left the courtyard for the shelter of the castle. Cornwall followed them and called for Gloucester to come along.
"But the storm," said Gloucester, watching his old friend through the bars. "No one should be out in this storm."
"He brought it on himself," said Cornwall. "Now, come along, good Gloucester."
Gloucester pulled himself away from the grate and followed Cornwall into the castle, leaving just Kent and me standing in the rain in only our woolen cloaks. Kent looked tortured over the old man's fate.
"He's alone, Pocket. It's not even noon, and the sky is as dark as midnight. Leah is outside and alone."
"Oh, buggering bugger," said I. I looked at the chains leading up to the top of the gatehouse, the beams that protruded from the walls, the crenellations at the top to protect the archers. Damn the anchors and billet for my monkey training as an acrobat.
"I'll go with him."
"But you have to hide Drool from Edmund. Talk to the laundress with the smashing knockers. She'll help. She fancies the lad no matter what she says."
"I'll go get help to crank up the gate," said Kent.
"Not to worry. You look after the natural and watch your back for Edmund and Oswald. I'll return with the old man when I can." And with that, I shoved Jones down the back of my jerkin, ran and leapt onto the massive chain, spidered up it hand over hand, swung up onto one of the beams that protruded from the stone above, then hopped from beam to beam until I could find a handhold in the stone, and scurried up another story to the top of the wall. "Sorry, sodding fortress," I shouted to Kent with a wave. In a wink, I was over the wall and down the drawbridge chains on the other side to the ground below. The old man was already at the gates of the walled village, nearly disappearing amid the rain, tottering out onto the heath in his fur cape, looking like an ancient, sodden rat. Act 3. Jesters do oft prove prophets. King Lear, Act 5, Scene 3. Regan. 17. Raining fools, hailing nutters.
"Blow, wind! Crack your cheeks! Rage! Blow!" thundered Leah.
The old man had perched himself on the top of a hill outside Gloucester and was shouting into the wind like a bloody lunatic, even as lightning raked the sky with white-hot claws and thunder shook me to my ribs.
"Come in from there, you bloody decrepit old loony," said I, huddled under a holly bush nearby, drenched and cold and at the end of my patience with the old man. "Come back to Gloucester and ask shelter from your daughters."
"Oh, ye heartless gods, send your oak-cleaving thunderbolts down on me. Burn me with your sulphurous and life-ending fires. Singe my white head and reduce me to a pillar of ash. Strike me dead. Let your wrath take fiery form and smite me. Take me. Spare no violence. I do not blame thee. Thou art not my daughters. I've given you nothing and expect no quarter. Do your horrible pleasure direct to a poor, infirm, despised old man. Crack the sky. Strike me dead."
The old man paused as a thunderbolt split a tree on the heath with blinding fire and a noise that would send statues to shitting themselves. I ran out from under my bush to the king's side.
"Come in, Nuncle. Take some shelter under a shrub, if only to take the sting out of the rain."
"I need no shelter. Let nature take her naked revenge."
"Fine, then," said I. "You won't be needing this."
I took the old man's heavy fur cape, tossed him my sodden woolen cloak, and retreated to my shrubbery and the relative shelter of the heavy animal's skin.
"Hey," said Leah, bewildered.
"Go on,"
said I. Crack the sky, fry your old head, mash your balls, etc., etc. I'll prompt you if you lose your place. And off he went again.
Mighty Thor, send your thunderbolts to cease this weary heart. Neptune's waves beat these limbs from their joints. Hecate's claws tear my liver and sap upon my soul. Baal, blast my bowels from their unhealthy home. Jupiter, strew the land with my shredded muscle.
The old man stopped his tirade for a moment, and the madness went out of his eyes. He looked to me.
It's really fucking cold out here.
Like being struck by a bolt of the bloody obvious on the road to Damascus, isn't it, Nuncle? I held open the great fur cloak and nodded for the old man to join me in it under my shrubbery. He crept down the hill, careful not to slip in the rivulets of mud and water that cascaded by, and ducked under the cover with me. The old man shuddered and put his skeletal arm around my shoulders.
Rather closer than we're accustomed to, eh, boy?
Aye, Nuncle. Did I ever tell you that you're a very attractive man?
Said Jones, poking his puppety head out of the cloak. And the old man began to laugh. And he laughed until his shoulders shook, and the laughter broke into a jarring cough, and that continued until I thought he might expectorate vital organs. I caught some freezing rain in my cut hand and held it for him to sip.
Don't make me laugh, boy. I'm mad with grief and rage, and I've no stomach for jests. You should stand clear, lest a thunderbolt scorch you when the gods heed my challenge.
Nuncle, begging pardon, but you arrogant old tosser. The gods aren't going to strike you down with a thunderbolt simply because you asked them. Why would they accommodate you with a thunderbolt? More likely a carbuncle, festered and gone fatal, or perhaps a thankless child or two, being how the gods love their irony.
The cheek, said Leah.
Oh, yes. Cheeky gods they are, said I, and you named off a bushel of them, too. Now, if you are struck down, we won't even know who to blame unless lightning brands a signature in your old hide.
You should have dared one, then waited an hour, perhaps, before calling fire down from the whole lot at a go. The king wiped rain out of his eyes.
I've set 1,000 monks and nuns to pray for my forgiveness, and the pagans slaughter goats by the herd for my salvation, but I fear it is not enough. Not once did I act in the interest of my people. Not once did I act in the interest of my wives or my daughters' mothers. I have served myself as God, and I find I am little forgiving. Be kind, Pocket, lest you one day face the darkness as I do. Or in absence of kindness, be drunk.
But, Nuncle, said I do not need to be cautious for the day when I become frail. I am frail now, and on the bright side there may be no God at all, and the evil deeds you've done will be their own reward.
Perhaps. I don't even rate a righteous slaughtering, sobbed Leah. The gods have sent these daughters to suck out my life-blood. It is punishment for how I treated my own father. Do you know how I became king?
Pulled a sword out of a stone and slayed a dragon with it, didn't you?
No, that never happened.
Sodding convent education. Bugger if I know then, Nuncle. How did Leah become king?
My own father. I murdered him. I do not deserve a noble death.
I was speechless. I had been in service of the king over a decade, and never had I heard of this. The story went that old King Bladud had handed the kingdom over to Leah and went to Athens, where he learned to be a necromancer, then returned to Britain and died from the plague in service of the goddess Minerva at the temple at Bath. But before I could gather my wits for a reply, lightning cracked the sky, illuminating a hulking creature that was making its way across the hillside towards us.
"What's that?"
I asked.
"A demon," said the old man. "The gods have sent a monster to take their revenge on me."
The thing was covered in slime, and walking as if it had just been constructed from the very earth over which it slogged. I felt for the daggers at the small of my back and pulled one from its sheath. There'd be no knife throwing in this downpour. I wasn't even sure I could hold the blade steady for a thrust.
"Your sword, Leah," said I. "Draw and defend."
I stood and stepped out of the shelter of the shrubbery. I spun Jones so his stick end was at the ready and drew a flourish in the air with my dagger. "Come hither, demon! Pocket's got a coach ride back to the underworld for thee!" I crouched, thinking to leap aside as the thing lunged. Although it described the shape of a man, I could see long, slimy tendrils dragging from it and mud oozing off of it. Once it stumbled, I'd leap on its back and see if I could cause it to fall and slide down the hillside away from the old king.
"No. Let it take me," said Leah.
Suddenly the old man shrugged off his fur cloak and charged at the monster, his arms wide as if offering his very heart to the beast.
"Slay me, ye merciless god! Rend this black heart from Britain's chest!"
I could not stop him, and the old man fell into the beast's arms. But to my surprise, there was no tearing of limbs or bashing of brains. The thing caught the old man and lowered him gently to the ground. I lowered my blade and inched forward. "Leave him, beast!" The thing was kneeling over Leah, whose eyes were rolled back in his head, even as he twitched as if in a fit. The beast looked at me and I saw streaks of pink through the mud, the whites of its eyes.
"Help me," it said. "Help me get him to shelter."
I stepped forth and wiped the mud away from the thing's face. It was a man, covered with mud so thick it even ran out of his mouth and coated his teeth, but a man just the same. Vines or rags, I couldn't tell which, trailed off his arms.
"Help poor Tom bring him out of the cold," said he.
I sheathed my dagger, retrieved the old man's cape, and helped the muddy naked bloke carry King Lear into the wood. It was a tiny cabin, barely enough room to stand in, but the fire was warm, and the old woman stirred a pot that smelled of boiling meat and onions. Like breath of the muses it was on this dank night. Leah stirred, now hours since we brought him in from the rain. The king reclined on a pallet of straw and skins, his fur cloak still steamed by the fire.
"Am I dead?" asked the old man.
"Nay, nuncle, but you were close enough to lick death's salty taint," said I.
"Back, foul fiend," said the naked fellow, waving at the very air before his eyes.
I had helped him wash away much of the mud, so now he was merely filthy and mad, but no longer misshapen.
"Oh, poor Tom is cold, so cold."
"Aye, we can tell that," said I. "Unless you're just a crashingly large bloke what was born with a willy the size of a raisin."
"The fiend makes Tom eat the swimming frog, the tadpole, lizards and ditch water. I eat cow dung for salads and swallow rats and bits of dead dogs. I drink pond scum, and in every village I am beaten and thrown into stocks. Away, fiend! Leave poor cold Tom alone."
"Blimey," said I,